This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Greg Mitchell, the co-author of the book Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning.
The case of Bradley Manning, who is currently on trial at Fort Meade, may be the most important court-martial in U.S. history. Despite his important revelations, there has been very little coverage of the trial. To remedy that, today Greg Mitchell will discuss both the history of the Manning case as well as the ongoing trial.
We'll talk with author Natsu Saito both about her book Meeting the Enemy, American Exceptionalism and International Law, and also about her practice as law as part of our Lawyers You'll Like series.
Is America the greatest beacon of freedom, liberty, and democracy, or is it something else? Do they apply international law evenly or selectively?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, Heidi, I've got a couple announcements on actions that are related to the guests that we've had on our show. The Free the Five people are organizing a big teach-in and rally in Washington from April 17th to the 21st. You can go to the website, The Cuban Five, that's a numeral five, thecuban5.org, to get the details. Danny Glover is going to be there. Dolores Huerta, the organizer of the United Farm Workers, is going to be there. And they're trying to give publicity to the case of the Cuban Five who were imprisoned, framed up for trying to defend the island against counter-revolutionary terrorist attacks launched in Miami with the winking approval of the U.S.
Michael, what day is that?
Free the Five on April 17th, and you go to the Cuban Five, that's numeral5.org, to get the details. Sal Landau is speaking. We interviewed him about his movie about the real terrorists. It's a terrific thing.
It's in Washington?
Yeah.
While you're in the neighborhood protesting the unjust and unlawful imprisonment of the Cuban Five, you might also make it over to Landover, Maryland, where the Coalition for Immokalee Workers, where my son Jake Ratner works, is doing a demonstration in front of Giant Foods. Once again, the demands are fair treatment of the tomato harvesters in Immokalee, Florida, the penny a pound, and ending abuse in the fields, and signing the Fair Food Agreement. You can go to the CIW website, ciw-online.org. And if you're going to get yourself to the Cuban Five, get yourself also over to Landover, Maryland, and protest in front of Giant Foods.
And if you want to stick around for the whole week, Michael, on April 24th, it's Mumia's 58th birthday, and our friend Francis Golden has organized an occupation of the Justice Department that day. You can go to info@OccupyJusticeDepartment.com. M1 of the Dead Prez is going to be there. It's a huge sit-in. I think a lot of people are going to get arrested. They're demanding a meeting with the Attorney General Eric Holder to ask him to look into the criminal frame-up of Mumia, the violations of his civil rights, and the corruption of the Philadelphia Police Department. Mumia is going to be 58 years old. He spent 30 of those years behind bars. He's off a death row in a big victory that we won. Next step is get him out of prison.
My faith in legal systems, even international legal systems, has again received a blow. I haven't had a lot of faith, but this one concerns the European Court of Human Rights. It's a court of really last resorts for people in Europe concerning human rights, the European Union and other countries as well. This particular case came to the European Court of Human Rights on the question of whether Britain could extradite five alleged terror suspects to the United States. The five people who have been imprisoned in Britain for a number of years claim that to extradite them to the United States would violate international law and the European Human Rights Conventions. They went to that court after losing in England. There's a request to extradite those five people to the United States. And sadly, last week, the European Court of Human Rights, hear that word, human rights, decided that these five suspects could be sent to the United States and that the U.S. system of justice is bad as it might be, was not a bar. But let's look at what it really said, because what were the five people complaining about? First, they were complaining that being sent to a supermax prison, particularly the prison at Florence, was torture as well as inhuman and degrading treatment. And why they said that was because they claimed that to send them to a supermax prison could constitute torture or inhuman and degrading treatment because they would be put in solitaire 23 hours a day. The prison cell would be completely walled. They couldn't really communicate with anyone outside of that. They would get very little exercise time, and they could be kept there year after year after year in solitary. Somehow, the court concluded such imprisonment would not be torture and inhuman and degrading treatment. To do that, and I won't go through all the details, the court said, for example, with regard to communication with other inmates, which of course you really can't do in the prison, that they could talk through the ventilator shaft to a prisoner next door. Now, if that's communication, you know, I'm a duck. I mean, that's ridiculous. So that's how far out of the way they went to say that imprisonment in a supermax prison did not constitute torture. A second claim raised by the suspect in the United Kingdom is that the holding of people by life without parole is not a violation per se of Article 3 of the European Convention, which is to say that, yes, in some circumstances it might be, but as a general matter, because there was a means of getting out of life without parole in some way, that it wouldn't per se be a violation of the European Convention. Again, ridiculous. Obviously, it's a crucial holding. It's like giving a green light to the United States to say, oh, we can hold everybody in prison life without parole, juveniles and otherwise. Terrible ruling. And the third part of the ruling, which is also extraordinary, was the claim by some of these suspects that they might be given life sentences for material support of alleged terrorist groups or terrorist groups as designated by the United States. And what the claim of the suspects was or is that those sentences are disproportionate to the conduct. How can you give someone a life sentence for that? Once again, the court went against the suspects. So, there you go. Despite the draconian conditions in the United States, supermax prisons, life without parole, disproportionate sentences to life, the European court upheld extradition to the United States. It's bad for people challenging extradition in Europe. It's bad for people in the United States who claim that their imprisonment in places like Florence and other supermax prisons somehow violates the law. Now the U.S. will say, well, look, the so-called more liberal courts in Europe found that you could extradite people here. There's nothing wrong with what we're doing. So it's a real blow. You have to look at it really in the context of 9/11. And you also have to look at it in the context of someone who I'm a legal advisor to, Julian Assange. One of the claims, if there's ever a request to extradite Julian Assange, if there's an indictment or there's a request, will be that his conditions of treatment in the United States will violate international law as well as the law of Britain, as well as the law of the European Human Rights Conventions. And of course, some of the claims will be he'll be put into a dark hole, he'll be kept in solitaire, he could be given a life sentence, etc. Well, those claims are going to be, unfortunately, somewhat harder to make after the European Court of Human Rights decision. And of course, you can even look at Bradley Manning's case, which we will discuss on this program. He was put into a very bad solitaire for 9 months. The UN Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, found that it constituted cruel and inhuman degrading treatment and could constitute torture. The question is, what would a court do with it after the European Court on Human Rights made this ruling in the case of five Britishers whom the United States asked for extradition? The upshot is bad ruling for Europe, bad ruling for the United States, and certainly bad for the five men who are going to be extradited. In the past year, we've brought you news about WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and Bradley Manning. Today, we're going to talk with Greg Mitchell, co-author of the new published book, Truth and Consequences, The United States versus Bradley Manning. The first part of that book, titled Solitary Man, gives readers a detailed look into who Bradley Manning is, why he might have allegedly done what he is charged with doing, as well as some of the extraordinary revelations the leaks brought out. The second part of the book, in an up-to-the-minute account, details the Bradley Manning trials that are continuing at Fort Meade. The book is the only up-to-date book on Bradley Manning and will be continually updated as the trial proceeds. In the preface to this important book, Greg Mitchell writes, quote, "Ultimate truths, in this case, may lead to ultimate consequences for one who would not be silent." What Greg is saying there is, here's a whistleblower who brought out some of the most important revelations about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and he may well suffer life imprisonment and conceivably the death penalty. Greg Mitchell, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm very happy to be here.
The book we're talking to you about, and really it's case we're talking to you about, and a man, The Truth and Consequences of the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. Remind our listeners, where is Bradley Manning right now and what's going on? And then let's go to some of the background.
The book, really the second half of the book, is really the only thing out there that in depth covers what has happened to him in the last few months, which is namely that his court-martial proceeding is finally proceeding after he was imprisoned for a year and a half with no day in court at all. Now that's starting to grind along. So his first hearing was last December. It took a full week, and Kevin Gostola, my co-author who writes for Fire Dog Lake blog, was one of the few journalists who was both at that hearing in December and then the follow-up hearing in April. So the second half of the book is entirely about the coverage of those two hearings. Quite dramatic revelations came out and so on, and now he is awaiting what is expected to be the start of the formal court-martial, perhaps in August. So when it does, if it does start in August, it'll be well over 2 years since he was arrested.
Now, your book also has, as an appendix, it has the 22 charges. What are some of those charges?
You know, some of them are fairly technical. It's about, you know, using the internet or using computers to disseminate information, classified information. There are some highly technical ones that have to do with how he allegedly did it. A lot of the charges are related to passing along, you know, allegedly to WikiLeaks, these classified secret information. Of course, the most dynamite charge is that he gave aid to the enemy. And then in one of these hearings, it was clarified who they refer to as the enemy. And the government was forced to say that they're going to be charging that it was Al-Qaeda. That charge, as you know, I'm sure, potentially carries the death sentence, execution. Although a judge early on suggested, though I'm not sure how you can promise such a thing, but suggested that the worst he would face would be life in prison.
Yeah, I think that was suggested, but I agree. I don't think there's any guarantees.
That, you know, that's such an outrageous smear to use. It's so devious. It's not like Al-Qaeda didn't know what was revealed. It seems to me that the enemy that's aided are people like me or you or Michael, who want to know something about what this government is doing in our name.
Right.
Talk about why they would charge him with aiding the enemy.
Well, there's various speculation about it, what it might be, but the whole Manning case from the beginning, of which that particular charge would be the biggest hammer, you might say, has been that the suggestion that they are trying to break him so that he will finger Julian Assange, that they, of course, they're interested in punishing Manning, but the big fish thereafter is Julian Assange, who is, as I'm sure listeners know, is the chief of WikiLeaks. So they've been not only in the charges, they're trying to link Manning directly to him, but from the charges and the treatment of Manning, you know, it's forgotten by a lot of people now, but last year, for months and months, in fact, it was just really a year ago, for several months, there was global outrage and protest over the treatment of Manning, where he was kept in solitary or virtually solitary confinement, all sorts of extraordinary things taken from him, and being kept under constant surveillance. And then in one period, his club being forced to strip naked and sleep naked and stand at attention naked and so on and so forth. And so there was charges then that the actual treatment of him was aimed at breaking him. So So here we are a year later, and the court-martial is going to go forward. Assange has still not been, you know, there's supposedly a grand jury that's been meeting in Virginia. They still haven't brought charges against Assange or anyone else. So we'll see what happens.
Your book is very good on a number of issues. We're talking to Greg Mitchell, co-author of Truth and Consequences, The U.S. versus Bradley Manning. It goes through what happened to him in solitary, as you just went through. And then it has a chapter each on some of the revelations that came out of the alleged leaks. And because I think a lot of our listeners and a lot of other people have just forgotten about how revelatory this is, right, can you just run over that? I know you have everything from the helicopters to the Afghan tapes to the cables, et cetera.
In fact, I did a column for The Nation just last week. We're celebrating, if you will, or marking the second anniversary of when WikiLeaks really came to full attention in the U.S., and it was with the release of the so-called collateral murder video that you just mentioned, shot from helicopters in Iraq, showing what many people consider a war crime, firing on civilians, and two Reuters staffers who were killed, brought to the attention that people had not seen before and caused quite a flap. And then the following summer, we had the release of the Afghanistan war logs, which had millions or hundreds of thousands of documents that showed what the U.S. was up to in Afghanistan. Again, the deaths of civilians, extreme corruption among the Afghan government, and on and on. And then a few weeks after that, there was the Iraq war logs, and this again showed conduct of the U.S. in Iraq, corruption, all sorts of things related to Iraq. And then finally, around Thanksgiving, was the release of the massive Cablegate, as it became known. And those releases continued for months and months and months, and again showing U.S. diplomacy or lack of diplomacy around the world. But mainly not so much the U.S. so much at fault as the other governments, and that continued for many months as well. So all those things are alleged to have come from one source, and that source allegedly is Bradley Manning, that he released the video, he released all those millions and millions of documents.
You have actually at the end of your book, and this is what you were blogging on, an appendix of some of the key, quote, Cablegate revelations. And they're extraordinary. I mean, each one of them, I worked on the Spanish cases having to do with prosecuting the Guantanamo torture team. Of course, you have one in here, a cable. U.S. tried to get Spain to curb its probes of Guantanamo torture and rendition. And you have another one. Your book opens in this appendix with Saudi donors remain the chief financiers of Sunni militant groups like Al-Qaeda. Remarkably extraordinary. Now, in light of all of these revelations, and, you know, people are still going through them, they're in the newspapers every day, something is used from WikiLeaks and the New York Times and the Guardian. It's constant, really. You know, I've gone to the trial. Why is it that it doesn't seem to be getting a lot of public attention right now, the Bradley Manning case? You know, Julian Assange, of course, still gets a fair amount of attention, but Bradley, there's very few journalists there. There's almost no spectators. And of course, we're not in the trial yet, but it's not high on the radar. Do you have any thought? I mean, your book is helping put it somewhere, but what's going on?
It's out of sight, out of mind. Media has other things to look at. There was a lot of attention for months with the revelations, and as we found out, the mainstream media, the Times and the Guardian and numerous other top sources around the world, embraced the revelations, ran the days and weeks of quotes from them. Even though they sort of deny it, they were sort of partners with Julian Assange in bringing this material forward. And then all the top places had a falling out with the WikiLeaks. They sort of turned against them. And I think there's been a spillover from that where, you know, they don't want to cover the Manning case, even though he may be, you know, dubbed, you know, the world's most famous, notorious whistleblower. They don't want to probe deeply into the case itself. And, you know, there are many people who feel Manning is a hero. There are others who feel he's not a hero, but that he, you know, he's been mistreated in terms of his being in prison, the charges against him. And then, of course, there's other people who feel he's, you know, a traitor. So there is a wide range of opinion about it, but there's not been the media coverage that reflects all those views and that really probes deeper into what's going on there, and the whole sense that it really is an attempt to get at Assange by going after Manning so severely.
I have a question on motive here, or reasons why Bradley Manning who allegedly uploaded all these documents up to WikiLeaks. You give a lot of evidence in the book that really allows, I think, readers of the book to decide on their own. But when the Frontline piece on Manning, which you then critiqued in the book, in your book, as well as I think there was a Times piece on Manning, and they sort of tried to depoliticize what Manning did, putting it to, you know, his being gay in the military and gender issues and all kinds of things like that. And then you also quote from a Lamo chat log, and you can explain to us who Lamo is, that gives a more political view. Can you just give our listeners some sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, it is possible to, you know, to have twin motivations. You know, I think people have tended to try to say he either was motivated by this or that, as it came out more and more that he was gay, he had gender issues, and there's a lot of that came out at these recent hearings. It allowed some people to just sort of say, oh, see, he just was, you know, he was mistreated, or he was upset about being gay or not being able to come out, or, you know, he shouldn't have been in the Army in the first place. In reality, that may all be true or may all be mainly true, but at the same time, in real time, as he was discussing, as you mentioned, with the Lamo chat logs, over and over, he cited his outrage at what he was seeing, at what he saw in those cables, and what he saw in Iraq, and cover-ups he saw in Iraq, things he was asked to participate in, and so forth. So it's not inconceivable. In fact, it's likely that he had, you know, more than one motivation, and it's completely wrong to just discount that he had any feeling of doing public good or feeling outrage at what he saw in releasing these documents. At the same time, the hearings and evidence shows that there were all sorts of warning signs that the military, you know, should have known, both because of his views and other things, that they repeatedly allowed him access to this material. I mean, I suppose the reason that you might think Manning might end up not getting off on a lot of these charges is that the court-martial will be extremely embarrassing for the military, because of the access they allowed him to these documents, various warning signs, various things he did that should have alerted them that he was maybe not the best person to have this extraordinary access to classified material. So it's going to be very interesting to see whether they cut a deal because of those things.
Talk to us about Bradley Manning. On the spectrum between hero and traitor, in my book, he falls on the hero side. But I don't know much about him, and you do. Share that with the audience, will you?
You know, he was a kid who grew up in Oklahoma. His parents eventually got divorced. He was a computer nerd growing up, no doubt. He realized in his teens that he was gay. He had very strained relations with his father. You know, he wasn't going anywhere particularly in a career and so forth, and so he joined the Army when he was 18 or 19. Typical, very, very typical story. Because he was a computer, like I said, a computer nerd, he was, I guess, directed into intelligence, and he was just another intelligence recruit, adept at what he could do, and ended up being sent to Iraq, and was given, along with many others, this extraordinary access to all these cables and reports from the field in Iraq and Afghanistan, and helicopter videos, and so on and so forth. You know, he had certain feelings. I mean, he wasn't a longtime peacenik or left winger or anything like that, but he always had some kind of social conscience, and when he got to Iraq, he did witness things that upset him and decided to do what he did. Since WikiLeaks, you know, has a policy of not talking about sources, exposing sources or so forth, it may have never come out that he would be arrested, except that he had these online chats with Adrian Lamo, who is a convicted hacker from years ago. Lamo decided Manning was just talking a little bit too much about what he allegedly did. Lamo decided to go to the authorities, and very quickly Manning was arrested. This goes back to the May of 2010.
And we're speaking with Greg Mitchell, co-author of Truth and Consequences, The United States versus Bradley Manning, that it was Lamo who really essentially gave up Manning. And in their most recent case here in, you know, New York, and I guess Chicago, with the Stratfor emails, the ones having to do with Stratfor, the the intelligence, right. Private Intelligence Corporation, was also an informant named Sabu who gave up that case. And so I think what you're seeing now is the FBI or whatever is starting to use a lot of informants within the sort of, quote, hacker community. I don't know if you thought about that at all.
Well, it is. It's interesting that in the year of WikiLeaks, I wrote a previous book called The Age of WikiLeaks a couple of years ago. And at that time, everyone was predicting that we were going to have this, both from WikiLeaks and other organizations, we were going to have one scoop after another, things leaked month after month. And even the New York Times was talking about setting up their own portal for leaks. I think the Wall Street Journal actually did set up a portal. So that was the expectation, and virtually nothing has happened. You know, Bradley, even within WikiLeaks, there were Gitmo files that came out. You mentioned the Stratfor files. But WikiLeaks has done very little. And really, there's no question that, except for Bradley Manning, in the last 2 years, there's been very little. So I think one of the reasons is because of this, there was a real crackdown. Obviously, the chilling revelations that Lamo, you know, went to the authorities. And, of course, Assange's own legal problems has tied up WikiLeaks, and a lot of people left WikiLeaks and so forth. So what was expected a couple years ago has not come to pass whatsoever. So one would think that along with some of the other crackdowns of the Obama administration on whistleblowers, and I'm sure you've talked about them a great deal in the past, it's been tough to continue that.
Well, Obama disappointed a lot of people who supported him because it seemed like he would encourage whistleblowing. But isn't it true that there have been more prosecutions of whistleblowers under Obama than in past presidencies?
Yeah, well, that's true. I'm not enough of an expert on that. That's no doubt. People like Glenn Greenwald have been very strong on that. He's also written a great deal about the Manning case and so forth. So, you know, it's kind of part and parcel, I suppose. But it's also, the Manning case also shows that this incredible legacy of our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which gone on for a decade, and it's never ending. And yet the American public has never been brought fully face-to-face with what the U.S. has done in those countries, civilian casualties. You know, we read now about the occasional drone strike that kills a few civilians or whatever. But right in these documents that were finally released, we saw sort of the routine death of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it allowed people who do the body counts to come up with new figures, 100,000, 120,000, 180,000, whatever the numbers may be, but based on hard documents. So, I mean, this is one of the legacies of Bradley. If indeed Bradley Manning did release this stuff, whatever else you may say about him, and there is a lot to say about him, he is the man who brought to the public and allowed experts and groups, organizations, to actually do the first, you know, semi-accurate tally of the full scope of the destructiveness of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, I want to come back to the point we made earlier, Greg, and that's that the aiding the enemy charge seems to me the enemy is the American public and informing the American public, and that's what they're trying to stop.
What was said originally, and this is all in the book, when these revelations came out, was that American lives were put at risk. The American soldiers were going to be killed. American diplomats were going to be killed. It's probably still true. There has been a single documented case of any American soldier, diplomat, or anyone else who has been, you know, killed or injured or shot at because of any of these revelations. They can say, well, we mean aiding the enemy in other ways, including existential, I guess. But in terms of this predicted, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Robert Gates or any, all these predictions that were made about, you know, people who would be killed, Americans who would die because of Bradley Manning and Julian Assange, has not come to pass at all. Now, that doesn't mean people were not inconvenienced. It doesn't mean that some people were transferred. And certainly diplomats were highly embarrassed. But they're going to have a hard time, and this we bring out in our coverage of the hearings in the second half of the book. The lawyers for Manning continually trying to get at the what is your evidence for harm that has been done, and that of course will be a key issue.
Yeah, it's a great part of the book. I mean, I've been at a couple of those days of hearings, and Kevin, your co-author, of course, has been covering it thoroughly. But even for me as a lawyer, and Kevin's not a lawyer, it's impossible almost to understand what's going on in court. I mean, partly because it's secrecy, and they don't, unlike a regular court, and we're going to eventually have to litigate it, they don't give you any of the motions that are filed. It's not because of classification. They just don't give them to you. They don't give you court orders. In the part you're referring to, the lawyer for Manning stands up and he says, you know, well, I want the damage assessments to show me, and just what you're talking about, what right. damage has there been? Right. And it just, it's like on a merry-go-round. They say, well, this is like 2 years later. We're still considering. They're still in like a process, you know, and there's this agency and that agency. It's like you feel like you're just in a Kafka-esque place anyway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And also the after the government presented, I don't know how many witnesses over 5 days, the defense was only allowed to call, I think, two. So they wrapped up their case in a couple hours. So, you know, they just were denied a chance to bring people in. Now, some people have said that may not be such a bad thing because they've, you know, they're keeping their cards face down and they're going to be able to have a more effective trial because of that, but really was completely imbalanced, the whole hearing process.
You can get the book, Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. You can get it on, you know, as a hard copy or online.
Right. It's available at Amazon, both the print and e-book. And e-book, you know, e-book nowadays via Kindle, all the apps, iPad and iPhone and so on and so forth. So it's really available in all formats.
Now, the way it is, it's so current and so up-to-date, and I know Kevin will be going down, your co-author, right. on April 24th to the next motion phase, which will be 2 or 3 days. Are you guys going to continue to update the book?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's the wonders of e-book. Even print you can update now. He'll come back on April 25th, and we'll have a new e-book edition by, you know, 3 days later. So it's really the wonders of modern publishing.
Greg Mitchell, and it's I who actually have some relationship. I'm an advisor to WikiLeaks, and I've been going to this, but this book is extraordinarily good from beginning to end. It's clearly written. It's easy to read. You know, we don't want to let the world forget about Bradley Manning.
Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. And you can get Greg Mitchell's blog at thenation.com. Greg, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. For our Lawyers You'll Like series, we welcome back attorney and professor Natsu Saito. In our last interview, Professor Saito mentioned how the current system of international law evolved from the broader agreement between the European colonial powers based on how they were not going to destroy each other in the process of taking over the rest of the world. It is this duality that Natsu writes about in her book, Meeting the Enemy, American Exceptionalism and International Law. Professor Saito joined the Georgia State College of Law faculty in 1994 and teaches international law, human rights, race in the law, immigration, criminal procedure, and professional responsibility. Her scholarship focuses on the legal history of race in the United States, the plenary power doctrine as applied to immigrants, American Indians, and the U.S. territorial possessions, and the human rights implications of U.S. governmental policies, particularly with regard to the suppression of political dissent. We talk with Professor Natsu Saito today about her work at the college and her book in the context of the invasion of Libya, current wars, and threats of war. Welcome, Natsu, back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, it's been a while, but the last time we talked with you, it was about your book, which had recently come out then, Meeting the Enemy, American Exceptionalism and International Law. Rave reviews about the book. Could you refresh our listeners what the topic essentially dealt with?
Basically, I was trying to look at the attitude of the United States being sort of superior morally, politically, legally, to other countries, and trace that attitude back through the history of the United States and even sort of back into some of the history of European colonialism more generally, to show that it's not just about current attitudes, that at that point the Bush administration's foreign policies, which certainly reflected that attitude, weren't aberrational, and to sort of show that that was a consistent theme throughout our history.
I think that you make the point of the consistency by pointing out that when the Americans assassinated Osama bin Laden, they called it Operation Geronimo.
Yes, yes. They're making it very clear for us if we wish to pay attention to history.
And Natsu, as a professor, what subjects do you teach?
I teach international law and international human rights and professional responsibility. And at times I've also taught race in the law, immigration, and criminal procedure.
And where do you teach?
I teach at Georgia State University's Law School in Atlanta.
So tell us, how did you get from where you started off to teaching these? Boy, I wish I could have had courses like that when I was in law school. How'd you get from where you started to where you are?
Well, I started out doing a lot of community organizing, and I moved down to Georgia in the 70s, and that was still a period in which there was a lot of active attempts to desegregate the university system, to deal with the blockbusting that was going on in residential real estate, to look at prison condition issues, you know, just all the those kinds of issues. And as I got more involved in it, I was a teacher at the time. I taught in some sort of private alternative schools, and I taught for the City of Atlanta's adult education program. And I always wanted to be a teacher. But as we got into a lot of political issues, people were always getting arrested, and we always needed more lawyers. So I thought, oh, well, I'll just go to law school, and I can help out. I didn't really intend to become a lawyer. And for a long time after I did become a lawyer, I was sort of mad at myself for having gotten diverted from work I really loved doing. So when I had the opportunity to go back into teaching, I was really, really happy about that.
How did your students respond to your book, Meeting the Enemy?
Well, I don't think most of them have read it.
Oh, it wasn't required course material?
No. I mean, I do, you know, incorporate the themes of it to some extent, but I was always uncomfortable assigning it.
I'm assuming it's not a radical student body. Are your ideas met with resistance?
Not generally. Partly, I expect, because my international law and human rights classes and the race law classes and whatnot are all electives. But we have at Georgia State, we have a somewhat older student body. A lot of them are working, and they have more experience in the real world. And what I try to do is to get them involved in actual international law issues or human rights issues that they care about. And so we sort of work from there, you know, to piecing together how the legal system addresses these issues and what some of the shortcomings are of addressing them within the domestic framework and what options the international legal, you know, bodies can provide in terms of addressing it. So I usually find that when you start from an issue that somebody actually cares about and then work from there, you don't meet the resistance because you're not coming at it from an abstract ideological position.
We wanted to ask you if there was student activism around the case of Troy Davis.
Yes, there was. There were a lot of students from Georgia State, although I would say more from the undergraduates than from the law students, although there was also among the law students. And that was a big concern for a lot of the students.
You're active politically in cases in different regards, and I know you're interested in the wave of suppression of political dissent that we've seen, especially over the last decade.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
One of the issues that I try to stay a little bit involved in, not that I contribute much, are cases of, like you said, of political prisoners, and particularly people who are being held in solitary confinement. One of the cases I'm particularly concerned about right now is that of Imam Jamil Al-Amin, who was, I believe, falsely convicted of a murder in Georgia and sentenced to life in prison in Georgia, and then was just whisked away to the federal supermax in Colorado. and has been held under very harsh conditions, I think, because of his political and religious views, not because of any behavior on his part.
Not to explain who he is, because he changed his name, and maybe some of our listeners don't know.
Yes, he was H. Rapp Brown, and an activist, and we know that he was targeted from the 60s by the federal government, and that we also know that even after he moved to Atlanta and became a well-respected imam in the community and was doing really, you know, very positive work among youth in the community, that he continued, there continued to be efforts to set him up, basically.
I remember his famously saying, justice in America means just us.
And
it certainly came home to victimize him.
There's, I mean, there's so many names of individuals in this condition. Russell Maroon Schoetz, also a former Black Panther who's been incarcerated, I think, almost 40 years, but half of that has been in solitary confinement at SCI Green in Pennsylvania. The reason that they give there is they're afraid at the age of 70 almost that he will be seen as a leader, a political leader who will inspire other inmates to resist.
Yes. And what we're seeing is, you know, back in the 60s and 70s when they were targeting political activists, when the federal government was targeting political activists, it was clear that they were identifying people because of their ability to influence others, like Fred Hampton, for example, right? Killing Fred Hampton was very significant because he was being effective in mobilizing a true rainbow coalition, not because he was a black separatist or, you know, whatever.
Right.
But they were always pretending like that's not what it was about. And now they're coming out and being quite blatant, right? Your ideas, your ability to have what some of us would consider a positive influence on other inmates or young people who are incarcerated makes you dangerous, and therefore we will impose these conditions. Mm-hmm. And that's really sort of the trend I see generally with so much of what has been happening recently, is the taking of these political suppression techniques that were at least covert in the 60s and 70s and bringing them out, normalizing them, legitimizing them in their framework, you know, making them technically legal and pushing one step further each time with the Patriot Act, with the Defense Authorization Act this time, you know, taking these types of COINTELPRO measures of spying on people and putting in informants and falsely accusing and arresting people and even assassinating people. We see that all being brought out into the open, and I find that particularly frightening that there seems to be acquiescence in that process.
We've seen it with the establishment of communication management units in which individuals such as Daniel McGowan, who was an animal rights activist, has been basically locked away, kept out of communication from others. And it does seem that even in those movements that have emerged in the last, you know, 15 or 20 years, those techniques that you describe are routinely now applied to target leaders or charismatic individuals who have a demonstrated track record that they can work to effect change.
Yes, it's like you are not allowed to be able to be an effective communicator of the so-called wrong ideas.
Mm.
And even if we look at Lynn Stewart's case, right, they tagged her with terrorism offenses for facilitating a communication that everybody concedes had no actual effect, but it was the communications restrictions on her client that end up getting her convicted.
Yeah, she issued a press release, and for doing that, they put her away for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, the person whom she was representing, his movement looks like it's coming to substantial power in Egypt.
That is interesting.
I read a very good article that you wrote some years ago after the U.S. Patriot Act was passed.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions you posed is, you're talking about homeland security, and you said, whose homeland and whose security? That was 7 years ago. Can you bring that up to date and ask that question again?
Yes, I think that really is becoming more and more clear, and it sort of ties back to some of the themes of this notion of American exceptionalism. You know, who is the American that is supposed to be so exceptional and what is the America that is supposed to be so exceptional. I really see that reflected sort of frighteningly across the political spectrum. Like, I think, you know, in campaign rhetoric of the, in the Republican primaries right now, you see this constant reference to America being exceptional and we want to bring the country back to what it was. And it's like, whose country are they talking about and who are they excluding? And it's fairly clear that they're not talking about people of color. They're not talking about poor people. They're not talking about, you know, any of these other groups, even though sometimes they claim to be sort of, you know, populist. But we also see it with, you know, the Obama administration's authorizing of assassinations and indefinite detentions of American citizens. Well, which American citizens are we talking about? And are they more secure? Are any of us more secure when this all rests on some secret executive branch decision? And then even with movements that seem in many ways to have wonderful political potential, like the Occupy movement, there is a sort of homogenizing of who it is we're talking about. And one example that will probably make your listeners hate me is in Denver, there was an effort made by folks in the American Indian movement and community here in Denver to get the Occupy folks to acknowledge that special, there has to be acknowledgement of the fact that this land was taken from American Indians and that American Indians still have a right to self-determination, not to just be lumped into, we all want a share of this ill-gotten pie, right? But when that was taken apparently to the national movement, it was resoundingly rejected as being divisive. And to me, that illustrates this notion that we get to define who's American, and then we get to propose a course of political action on their behalf. But each of these sectors has exclusionary definitions of who's an American. And I find that really troubling.
Natsu, going back to your book, Meeting the Enemy, American Exceptionalism and International Law, I think it's been a year since we've had you on to talk about that. And we've been disappointed with President Obama's record, the invasion of Libya, other military actions. You've referenced some of our policies. But what's your take on what we're facing in the next year or so? What are the repercussions from our ill-gained military power?
Selectively applying international law.
Right.
Yes. I think that that's a really major problem. And that was a lot of what I was talking about in there, is this sort of selective reliance on international law. It's one of the misperceptions, I think, is that the United States doesn't care about international law. In fact, it utilizes international law heavily in certain arenas, for example, in preventing people in poor countries from getting access to drugs that U.S. pharmaceutical companies have patents on and that are protected by certain, you know, intellectual property agreements. But on the other hand, being willing to flout international law very dramatically, and I think the invasion of Libya is a good example of that, of going into another country that is in a certain state of political turmoil and essentially moving in to assassinate its leaders. I think the assassination of Osama bin Laden falls in that category. These are things that are being justified based on the personal characteristics of these individuals, which is very dangerous. You know, it violates longstanding international law on both state sovereignty, but also the way in which political participation and, you know, true democracy is supposed to be working, which the United States claims to be promoting. If you can go in and assassinate those individuals that you don't like, that completely throws out of whack international law in terms of sort of state-to-state relations, but also it sets up the precedent for anybody we don't like, we can just assassinate rather than giving due process of law to. I find that setting a very frightening precedent, and I think the renewal of the drone strikes in Pakistan is another good example of that. I don't think that international law as it exists allows those kinds of measures. I don't think the United States would begin to argue that they were legal if It was, you know, at least half of the rest of the countries of the world doing it. And it undermines the entire system in a way that really says might makes right. And that's a dangerous position for everybody right now in the world. But it's also dangerous for the United States because there's no assurance that the United States will always be the most powerful country in the world.
Michael Ratner and I did a book on the assassination of Che Guevara. He was murdered in 1967. And we studied the history of the CIA and their covert program of assassinations. They either succeeded or attempted to kill 18 different foreign leaders from 1948 to 1967. What they did was always kept secret. And now what's so unsettling is they're still doing it, but now they're bragging about it. And their whole efforts since 9/11 to go after terrorists, rather than declare war on a country, they declared war on an idea or a tactic, and that then allows them to go out and assassinate whoever they deem to be an enemy, and then brag about it, which was particularly unsettling. And it's especially unsettling when you see that they've now killed two American citizens, Alawaki, and then the next week his 16-year-old son. And you wonder, what's next? Because these wars abroad tend to become wars at home.
Yes. No, I think that's really problematic. I mean, those activities have always been very problematic and troubling. But the fact that they're no longer even pretending not to do that, I think is even more significantly problematic, because the value in the legal system and in adherence to the rule of law from the perspective of making the world a better place, I think, is that there are certain principles and ideals articulated against which you can measure actual state action or behavior. And if those ideals, there's no longer even a pretense of adhering to those ideals, then the whole system crumbles, and the justice that can be obtained through the legal system is completely subverted.
Natsu, I note that one of the courses you teach is professional responsibility. I personally think that is an undervalued, usually poorly taught part of legal education, and that it should really be incorporated in all aspects of a legal curriculum. What's your approach to it? And if you could also sort of briefly summarize what you see as the major problems with young attorneys vis-a-vis professional responsibility.
That is, I completely agree with what you said about it being a problem that we kind of cabinet to this one, usually 2-hour course, and say you have to learn certain rules and be able to pass a standardized test about them and check that box and let's move on. I think that it's a really exciting course to me because it has everything to do with what the students are there for. Like, they came to law school because they wanted to be lawyers for some reason, and it's all about what that means and what being part of the legal profession means. And I think that that's true regardless of one's political ideology or perspective on this. I mean, the legal system plays a really critical role in this society, and whatever critiques you have or don't have of the way the legal system functions, it's clearly essential that if it doesn't function, the society as a whole loses legitimacy and credibility. So I usually start out with the clip from, do you know that Spencer Tracy movie, Judgment at Nuremberg?
Oh, yes.
Which is the trial of the judges, right?
Yeah.
And so I usually start out with some clips from that talking about, look, these are lawyers and judges on trial. They were upholding the law as it existed in Germany at the time, but they're being tried for crimes against humanity. What does that tell us? How do we understand that? How do we understand what the rule of law means as distinct from particular laws? And then sometimes I followed up with when the Pakistani lawyers were having demonstrations because the Constitution had been suspended and the Supreme
right.
Court had been sort of suspended too. And there were some great clips on the news about Pakistani lawyers out in the streets turning over police cars and setting them on fire. I don't know if they're setting them on fire, but like beating up police cars. That generated some really interesting discussions about who's upholding the rule of law here, right? What are the motivations? How do you assess these things? And why is the rule of law important, and then how do we look at the way in which the legal system functions on a more mundane day-to-day level and tag that back to the rule of law? How do you make those decisions about what's really furthering the purposes of the rule of law and what's subverting it, even in the name of the law? Then we can get to sort of lawyers being a self-regulating profession and what that implies in terms of individual responsibility and collective responsibility among lawyers. What do we do about the fact that 80% of all criminal defendants can't afford a lawyer? What does that say about the nature of the legal system, and what should we be doing about it? It opens up a lot of possibilities, I think, of for whatever kind of law people want to practice or what they want to do with their lives, of really looking at it in a bigger context than I need a job and I need to pay my bills.
So thank you very much, and keep up the good work. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you so much.
Want to hear Law and Disorder again? Go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.